I'll give you Cruz in this recording from his book, One Nation Under God, which is subtitled How Corporate America Invented Christian America, which is a pretty interesting thing and should be doubly interesting for those of you who consider yourself supporters of Christianity and capitalism. If you think that these two things naturally go together and our country is good in part because of the connection between these two things, then you ought to be somewhat disturbed to realize that, well, this is a complete construction. And not only is it a complete construction, but the construction that was carried out by a very large group of ministers, but by no means the majority of American ministers, was actually backed by corporate America. Maybe a whole lot of you will actually not be surprised about that either. So I'm going to just say what I think are the most important things to look for and to think about. There's really one thing that I want to get to, which is I want to talk about how ideologies are constructed. I think there's some nuanced understanding that, you know, it's not that the Bible supports capitalism or the Bible supports socialism. It's not that the Bible says Christianity is all about individualism. Of course, the Bible predates Christianity. But it's not that the Gospels, it's not that the New Testament just supports individualism or that it just supports community. It can do both of those things, and it has done both of those things historically. The trick simply lies in making a careful selection from the Bible or from the New Testament in order to support whatever it is that you want to support. An ideology, in large part, has this character. This is where I want to go today. It draws upon pre-existing ideological elements, for example, the Bible, or in this case also the Declaration of Independence and some other things. It draws on those pre-existent ideological materials. It selects from them. It synthesizes them with new things. For example, when FDR espoused the social gospel using the Bible in order to support the position that our ethical obligations have to do with supporting the poor and preventing poverty and redistributing wealth for the benefit of the majority and so on, he borrowed certain portions from the Bible, but he also was already in tight communication with John Maynard Keynes, who was an economist. So as an economist, Keynes is, we'd like to think that he's just developing mathematical models, say a scientific economic theory, but in a lot of ways, he's probably also picking from the pre-existent economic tradition in order to push one or another position. So at least among other things, Keynes is an ideologist. So what FDR and the Federal Council of Churches who were supporters of him were doing was selecting from the Bible and linking together their selections and also selecting from the American tradition, specifically American transcendentalism, and then linking it together with newer ideological production in order to get a rhetorical defense of the New Deal program. But the same thing happens immediately afterwards on the right. They draw from the Bible. They draw from pre-existing traditions in the United States like Carnegie's Gospel of Wealth. And then they synthesize that selection from pre-existing ideologies with contemporary economy as well, but economy that is directly opposed to Keynesianism. So it's von Mises and Friedrich Hayek. Both sides are doing the same thing, and they're doing the same thing on the basis of the same heritage, the same inheritance of ideology. And they're probably distributing by the same means, with the exception that the right here, the Christian right now, which is not exactly what the Christian right maybe could be or should be, but the movement with which James Fifield is associated, the one that's covered in this chapter, shows the massive extent of funding and then the massive extent of distribution of these intentionally crafted messages. I mean, that's the main thing that I want you to start to realize, is that the ideology with which we're surrounded is built out of old ideologies. And in order to build and distribute support for a certain set of economic, military, social positions, all you have to do is selectively draw from the tradition, and then you have to have a good marketing scheme. You have to have a good sense as to what is going to fly and what's not. And then you have to have massive access to distribution machinery, which is what corporate America gave to this particular variant of Christian America in the 1940s and the 1950s. Okay, so the story that is told in this chapter basically says, okay, look, In the 1930s and the 1940s, corporate America had a public relations problem. It was difficult for manufacturers to persuade masses of people of their basic goodness, of their importance, of the idea that they ought to get what they want. Now, it's important for them to be able to sway public opinion because they want to sway legislation. So, okay, why do they have a problem? Why do they have a PR problem? They have a problem because of the Great Depression. That's the starting point. But there are a number of things that are compounded here. The Great Depression, 1929, the stock market crash, the 1930s, the Depression itself, were coupled with a growing labor movement. So the American labor movement, in a lot of ways, starts in the late 1800s. In a lot of ways, it also starts out west with mining. But then as these big industries grow, especially in the Midwest, the steel industry, the oil industry, unionization happens there as well. And because of the Depression, the unions get a whole lot more steam. Part of the New Deal, effectively, was the Wagner Act, which I've mentioned several times, which legalized labor unions. It required legally, it established the National Labor Relations Board, and it required corporations, owners, managers, to negotiate with unions, to recognize them as legal entities who were representing the interests of the workers. Now, the degree to which that happens or the degree to which labor unions become corrupted is a separate question. There are, I think, unarguably ways in which the unions, especially the early unions, the AFL and the CIO, they really improved the material conditions of workers. That's kind of hard to get around. Although you might want to say it was grassroots labor activism that achieved that, and the large-scale unions just sort of harnessed it and then profited from it. There are also ways in which mass-scale unionization made work worse, made it more uniform, made it less likely that there were going to be anything like wildcat strikes and so on. But anyway, all that is a conversation for another day. But because of the crash, because of the power of the labor union, and of course, when a labor union has a lot of power, that's a material term, or at least it ought to be a material term, or I would suggest it risks losing meaning. If power is a material term, it means the capacity to do things. And among the things that large-scale, powerful unions inevitably can do is to distribute ideology. It can distribute a message which corresponds, either really or at least in principle or in the estimation of the union, to the perspective of the worker. And the perspective of the worker is antagonistic to the perspective of the owner. The owner wants to pay less. The worker wants to be paid more. The owner wants not to spend money on safety precautions. The worker wants every safety precaution possible, and so on. So 1929 makes capitalism look bad. It makes it look like capitalism is an unstable system. It makes it look like those who profit most from capitalism are irresponsible citizens who don't really care much about the rest of the society, who are playing a dangerous game which affects us all. And when it does affect us all, it goes really big scale, really fast. I mean, there's all kinds of reason after 1929 or, you know, after 2008, although, of course, we don't have the same aftermath. There's all kinds of reason to doubt the wisdom of a capitalist system, or at least of a capitalist system that is not regulated in some fashion. And this is, you know, 1936 is about the point where John Maynard Keynes becomes the most prominent economist consulted by, well, especially by the federal government in the United States, because Keynes recommended a regulated economy, a regulated capitalist economy. He was not a socialist exactly. He did probably recommend a whole bunch of things which were steps towards socialism and which became parts of the New Deal. So you have the labor movement, you have the crash, you have the Depression, and then you have the New Deal. So the New Deal is the agreement that the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt arrived at. It's a complex web of legislation. Maybe you could break it down into a bunch of programs on the one hand to improve the situation of the poorest people in the United States, job programs, unemployment insurance. The Social Security is born out of the New Deal. These are all, by the way, things that corporate America hates and thinks ought to go away entirely. And then on the other hand, legislation aimed at regulating capitalist actors, stopping them from speculating like crazy, reining in their capacity to operate without oversight, insisting upon greater safety regulations, all the rest. Big, complex web of alterations, which, you know, depends on how you look at FDR. You could just look at FDR as like a hardcore liberal who, because of circumstances, got to carry through a whole bunch of liberal socialist-leaning reforms. But I don't think that's really where he was at. I came across a quote by him at one point saying, the New Deal saved capitalism. You know, I don't think it's true that FDR is a socialist, but he enacts measures that treat capitalism as if it were not a good in itself. Maybe it's a powerful engine for production and maybe for wealth generation, but it needs to be kept a hold of. The way that I look at FDR and the New Deal is that he was basically forced to do what he did, lest the labor movement and the mass armies of the unemployed become so large and so unruly that they actually threaten the stability of the federal government, and with the stability of the federal government, also the stability of the hold of the owners upon the land and the means of production, the other means of production within our country. His hand was forced. He had no other choice. The New Deal had to happen, or else there would have been revolution. This is another way to look at it. And maybe that's true, maybe it's not true. It's a hypothetical. But at any rate, the New Deal did happen. And consequently, manufacturers were not in nearly the privileged position that they had been in, say, like 1900 in the aftermath of the Civil War, during this period during which the massive trusts grow. That kind of unfettered expansionism was less possible come 1930, 1935. So what are they going to do? Well, they tried to alter public perception of the nature of capitalism, the rightness of capitalism, the rightness of the owning class, the right to property. And they tried to do this by various public relations campaigns. Notice that there's already like a little bit of intentional obfuscation there going on, because when GM talks about private property or about property, you know, it's not talking about the same thing that you would be talking about if you talked about your property. And I can tell you about my property. I have a house that we are halfway done paying off, and a lot, and I have a Honda Fit, and I'm looking out my door, and I have like a barbecue. It's really old. Actually, no, that's not mine. That belongs to my friend Carl. I have a green table that was given to us 10 years ago. You know, those are my possessions. That's my property, but that's not the kind of property that corporate America is concerned with. Their property is massive. It's large scale. It consists sometimes in factories and other infrastructural means of production. Often it consists in capital deposits in the millions and billions and potentially the trillions of dollars. Their property is not the same as our property, but the rhetoric speaks as if it were. So the PR campaigns that were carried out, and Cruz will give you like list after list of all the different corporations that supported one and another campaign here. These campaigns were attempting to persuade the public that they needed capitalists. The capitalists were heroes. They're trying to repopularize that kind of Carnegie gospel of wealth type rhetoric, which suggests that the real individuals, the real Americans, the real benefactors of the whole American civilization are these few exceptional capitalist industrialists. They were trying to revive something like that, because when the public held that opinion, legislation in the favor of owners was more likely. Anyway, so the problem is they have a PR problem, and they try to deal with it. And they deal with it first directly through their business association, the National Association of Manufacturers. People look at this and they're like, oh, that's just propaganda. Then they decide to establish a kind of front organization. Now, this is really important. And one of the things that we should be leading up to is the recognition that a whole bunch of contemporary institutes, which are nominally institutes for the advancement of moral and religious principles. So, for example, the American Enterprise Institute or the Edmund Burke Institute. These are things that exist today. I mean, I would even say the Rand Corporation, but that one is a little more complicated because it works for both the Republicans and the Democrats, but that's just because they all work for the same corporations. But anyway, American Enterprise Institute, as an example, is clearly it's really a Republican group, but really behind it is economic interests, big corporate property holders. So this idea of making a front organization that pretends only to have civic concerns, but really has economic backing and an economic agenda. This is sort of founded around this time, and it doesn't go very well to begin with. The American Liberty League, according to Cruz, is seen right through as well. And any sites, you know, reviews and responses in the press to the American Liberty League's propaganda. Like, people could still tell, like, oh, this is just GM and Republic Steel and U.S. Steel. It's just them again pretending to be somebody else. And so what basically happens is that the National Association of Manufacturers starts spending more and more money on public relations. And notice this is important. Like, this probably couldn't have happened in the same way in the late 1800s, because the machinery for the distribution of ideological material, the environment in which a public opinion on a large scale could fairly readily be constructed in a fairly short term period, if your campaign was agile and powerful enough, that environment didn't exist back in the 1880s. So, like, this capacity to produce public opinion is, relatively speaking, a new capacity. Anyway, that one fails. The American Liberty League fails. But then comes along this dude named James Fifield, who's a preacher, an apostle to millionaires is the phrase that was used to describe him. And he basically says, okay, look, what you got to do is put faith into your PR campaign. Let's make this all about faith and values and religion. And you can still support it, but we're going to get clergy to do most of the work here. To me, this is really important too. If you want to understand how ideology works and move towards understanding the notion of ideological state apparatuses with Louis Althusser, which in a lot of ways comes from this Italian theorist in the early 1900s named Antonio Gramsci, both of them thought part of the way that power in a society shifts is by struggles within different social institutions where one or another faction becomes dominant. So what's happening in the story that we're reading today is that there's a struggle going on for control over the ideological state apparatus of the church. There's this massive network of churches all across the United States, and Americans go to these churches on a regular basis. Now, all these churches, they're of different affiliations, and they have theological differences with one another. And the game is, how do you infiltrate the maximum number of them? How do you get them propagating the message that you would like them to propagate? How do you take over an ideological state apparatus? How do you take over the church? Well, this is how they went about it. So Fifield is just a big organizer at a big church with a whole bunch of very powerful individuals with a whole bunch of money. So he starts using that particular church. He builds it out. He radically increases the membership. He starts running these outreach programs. But then he also starts building networks. He starts building networks between what you probably would call conservative ministers across the United States. But you should be really careful about the conservative thing. And Cruz points this out too, because they're not conservative in their reading of the Bible. One way of looking at, like, you know, conservative Christianity, and I think of this as, you know, associated with the evangelicals, although they don't actually do it. They say they do it. You know, the Bible is literally the word of God, and you have to believe every single thing that is written in the Bible literally. That would be one conservative Christian position. Fifield has nothing to do with that. He's like, no. Like, you know, some parts are better than others. Don't worry about that. The conservative stuff is totally political and economic conservatism. Politically, Fifield is a supporter of ownership, of property, of big property, and of the hierarchy that goes along with it, of the prestige that goes along with it. And what he does is recommend selectively picking from the scriptures, putting it together with selections from economy in order to generate a new gospel, which I suppose we could call the gospel of free enterprise. So his movement comes to include a whole bunch of other pastors all the way across the United States, and they get massive distribution for their messages. So by 1943, Fifield's he succeeds in getting 2 million people to sign an official pledge versus paganism. But of course, there's already a rhetorical game going on there, because he's calling fascist Italy and Germany pagan statism, because it's easy to pick on the enemies of a country at war, but he really means the criticism of those countries to extend back to the United States. A whole bunch of the stuff that he has to say you're going to recognize. By the late 1940s, they're on 150 radio stations. By 1950, 500 radio stations. By 1951, going on 1,000 radio stations. In that year, they carry out a nationwide Freedom Under God Day of Action, in which preachers simultaneously preach on the evils of the New Deal, basically. So these are all the enemies of FDR and the enemies of Keynes and the enemies of a regulated capitalism, pooling their resources, getting behind an ideological strategy, a propaganda campaign, which operates using the material of a Christian tradition, coupling it together with a radically conservative political vision, and sending it through the distributive apparatus of a large network or a network of networks of religious organizations. Okay, so one way you can look at what he's doing is he's trying to reverse values, and he's trying to reverse values in order to create a context in which it's easier for big money to do exactly what it wants, where big money will be taxed less, where big money will be regulated less, where big capital will be relieved of obligations to pay into Social Security, for example, or to pay into unemployment insurance. There's money on the line here, and big money wants to maximize its money, but it's using this purely, or nearly purely, religious message and religious distribution network in order to achieve its goal. So what's the revaluation? The revaluation says, okay, the New Deal, everybody's saying it's good. It sucks. It's terrible. It looks like it makes, you know, poor people happier, but it's evil in a way. In fact, it encroaches on American freedoms, because the most important American freedoms have to do with freedom of property, freedom of enterprise. Some of the stuff that I'm sure you've heard, and which I even agree with in certain respects, but not the respects that these guys do, the idea that the executive branch has gotten too strong, that's originally an attack on FDR, because the executive branch is spearheading the New Deal. And so we can say, or what Fifield says, is that America is headed for a dictatorship unless we back off the power of the government. But they don't mean back off the power of the government, for example, to break strikes. They're down with that. They don't mean break off the power of the government to carry out wars. They're down with that. They're the ones that make bank off of the weapons manufacturing and sales. And in many cases, they're the ones who benefit from the war itself, or they want wars to take place. No, that's not the reduction of the state that we want. The state reduction we want is in the regulation of industry. That's what's got to be backed off. But then we put this in a totally religious language. So the New Deal violates the commandments. It involves the worship of government, which is kind of pushing it, which is, you know, the worship of false idols. It involves coveting. And I think this is one that we do think about. Poor people should be more moral than they would be being if they were to want what the rich have, which to me is relatively insane. You know, you should be a good little person and not want what anybody else has, but that's what they're saying. They even say that it bears false witness. It lies, because it says that what is impossible could be possible. You know, everybody being equally rich, for example. And then they refer back to the work ethic, for example. And then they say the New Deal destroyed thriftiness, industriousness, initiative, resourcefulness, all these things that are built into the American tradition from the Puritan root, and kind of clustered around the idea of the work ethic. They say, okay, the New Deal violates that. They want to make the New Deal anti-American, right? They don't like, and they want to get rid of, the minimum wage, price control, Social Security, unemployment insurance, VA benefits, all kinds of taxes. These are clearly things that benefit the corporate elite, but they're presented as if they were bad from the perspective of everyday people. And of course, we're familiar with this rhetoric, right? What's insane is that it still works, that people who need more money because they can't get by without getting into debt should also think that a minimum wage is bad. That's like a crazy variety of dual consciousness. And it's only possible because of the authoritarian relationships going on here, where people believe things that come from a particular source, in this case, their preacher, contrary to their own experience and their own needs. If they insisted on just thinking things through from their own perspective, they would never believe this stuff. Okay, and what are we going to put in place of that? The core American rights have to do with property. Our rights are like to live, work, and worship, not to receive unemployment or whatever. This country was founded on religious faith. We want to go back to what America was. We want to make America great again. They don't say it exactly that way, but Trump isn't the first one to say that. Reagan says exactly that in 1980. Let's make America great again. But it's based on this same conservative tradition, which is basically being, in a lot of ways, it's being manufactured here at this point in history. Okay, so let me just like return very quickly to that thing that I talked about at the beginning. I would like to point out, and by the way, I'm going over the notes pretty directly here, so you can check out the notes if you want. What's going on is that there is a pre-existing set of ideological materials in the American context in, say, 1940. the Bible. How many copies of the Bible exist in the United States in 1940? I mean, millions, right? There's all these different Christian traditions, and there's the networks and churches that go along with them, especially Puritanism, but also Quakerism, which sort of, I think, feeds into the social gospel preferred by FDR. There's the whole history of English preaching about the work ethic and about success, which comes out of bourgeois Protestantism. It's kind of like an ideology for the bourgeois of England in the 1600s. Then there's the history of American preaching about the work ethic and about success. And when I say the success ideology at this point, maybe we could abbreviate it and say, like, well, what that basically means is the position that if you are successful, it's because God is smiling on what you've done. And therefore, success is also a sign of morality, of goodness. And the other way around, if you are good, you're going to be successful. And this allows us to look at successful people and say they deserve everything they got. It allows us to affirm the unequal distribution of respect and money, and also to look at the poorer portions of the population and say, well, I guess you're just kind of crappier people, and maybe you've made bad decisions, and so you are where you are because of what you've done, and so I can't really help you out. Again, this allows us to reaffirm the unequal distribution of money, happiness, and power to make decisions. So the success gospel is already there from, like, Cotton Mather, for example, in the 1700s. The social gospel, this is not something that we talked about, but that the reference that Cruz makes is that that's an American transcendentalism. So the social gospel people, the New Dealers, they pick up a portion of, say, like Ralph Waldo Emerson's writings. Not all of it, because there's some seriously conservative stuff in there too. They only take some of it in order to bolster their position, in order to develop their ideological position. On the other side, people like Fifield pick up another portion of Ralph Waldo Emerson's writing, specifically the idea about self-reliance. That side, there's also Carnegie's Gospel of Wealth that we read about when we read Huber some weeks ago. The idea that, well, it's a sort of necessary evil to have capital versus labor, but really the capitalist is an exceptional individual and is ultimately helping the whole race and is generally raising the quantity of happiness in the world, and so we should see them as a benefactor. There's all these pre-existing doctrines, and you can pick them apart and choose certain things. There's also the Declaration of Independence, and Fifield and his spiritual mobilization campaign, they actually edited the Declaration of Independence so that they could emphasize individualism and anti-governmentism, but skip over things that had to do with the demands of the colonists for good government. So there's a selection. Powerful groups with some means to process ideology. So you have to have actual ideologists working this stuff through, piecing together the different pieces of writing, making new writing on the basis of old writing, but also then have an economic stake. There's a reason to spend money, etc., on this stuff, and they have access to machinery of distribution. Then they start distributing in order to try and line up public opinion along the lines that they want it to go. And in this case, the distribution is extremely broad, and it has lasting consequences to this day. So the only last point I'll make is that, you know, there's an interesting circular thing going on here, that because the materials from which either one of these doctrines, the social gospel or the gospel of free enterprise, which are really opposed to one another, because they're both made out of old pre-existent ideological elements, they both have a certain believability. That is, people, when they hear one or the other of these frameworks, which of course correspond to what's right or wrong in terms of major decisions about regulation or non-regulation of industry, minimum wage or not, war or not, when they hear these arguments, they are likely to say, oh, well, that's obviously true, because of that obviousness. I mean, this is what Althusser will tell us. Obviousness is the sign of ideology. You know, like when something is just appears as obvious, you should realize that that's because you've been indoctrinated along these lines. The obviousness that has already been built in because we all read certain school books, because we've all been exposed to repetitious messaging in one and another format through our entire lives via the media. Then when we get a new ideology, but it's constructed out of these old elements, it retains some of that feel of tradition, feel of common sense. And that's one of the reasons that they want to draw on these things. Like, why would corporate America want to draw on the Christian tradition and work through the Christian network just because it is already a tradition, just because it already commands minds, just because it already integrates opinion into large blocks. If you can access those large blocks of opinion, if you can sway them, then you can sway action too.